This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to Encounter on ABC Radio National. I'm Gary Bryson. This week, religious fundamentalism and terrorism. How can we understand the links between these two highly loaded terms?
Given the contemporary pressing need to be able to identify, predict, locate, and so hopefully counter any potential terrorist extremism born of certain intense expressions of religion, usually identified in some ways as fundamentalist, then the task of analysing the phenomenon of religious fundamentalism so as to construct a paradigm capable of providing both interpretation and perhaps a measure of predictability would seem an imperative task. It is this task that I seek to address.
Dr. Douglas Pratt giving the keynote speech at a recent conference in Sydney. Dr. Pratt is director of the Religious Studies Program at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies, the University of Waikato in New Zealand. The conference he was speaking at was organised by the Catholic Institute of Sydney, and the theme was truth and truthfulness in uncertain times. You might remember our programme on that conference just a few weeks ago. Well, Dr. Pratt's paper was entitled Fundamentalism and Terrorism, the Contemporary Religious Challenge. In it, he examined the difficult intersections between religious fundamentalism and violence, asking the question, at what point does fundamentalism spill over into terrorism? And can this be predicted with any certainty? It's a discussion which takes in not only Islamic fundamentalism, but also groups like the Exclusive Brethren, ideological secularists, and even the motivations of World War II kamikaze pilots. What follows are edited highlights of Dr. Pratt's presentation and a subsequent interview in which he further clarifies some of his points.
In its Christian religious context, the term fundamentalism originated in America. A series of booklets issued during the second decade of the 20th century, simply titled The Fundamentals, was published to promote the view that there is a bedrock, defining and non-negotiable set of traditional Christian doctrines. From the proposition that Christianity rests on the set of fundamental doctrines, there arose into earlier the use of the term fundamentalism to refer to the generic idea proposed by the publication of the booklets. At the time, the badge of fundamentalism was proudly worn. True religion was combating the inroads of a destructive liberalism. Subsequently, fundamentalism has achieved a wider application and attracted considerable academic interest. One important and significant study in the later 20th century was the Fundamentalism Project, a five-year study which was sponsored by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. During the 1990s, this led to the publication of several substantial volumes, as you probably know. These showed that religious fundamentalism can imply a narrow, strict, and limited metaphysics and set of doctrines, which to a greater or lesser degree hardly impinge on the wider life of a society. On the other hand, they also show that fundamentalism can mean a worldview perspective that engenders, if not demands, the advocacy of a socio-political ordering and action to achieve an intended outcome. Further, these studies show that an imagined golden age believed to have pertained at the religion's foundation is held up in the context of a fundamentalist position as the model and reference point for contemporary reality. In a nutshell, they conclude that fundamentalism cannot be taken as an epiphenomenon reducible to politics, which tends to be the line taken by some secular and political commentators, nor is fundamentalism to be dismissed as a passing religious fad or a phase, wait a bit longer and they'll grow out of it kind of thinking. Rather, fundamentalism is discerned as something which is deep-rooted, a deep-rooted ideology which itself gives rise to political acts. Fundamentalism, as a term in its origins, emerged out of and was defined
wholly in terms of a Christian context, so that in its original religious usage, the term fundamentalism was actually naming a very particular set of Christian beliefs and the promotion of a certain set of Christian values. What happens in the Christian camp is this. For a long time, we have recognized that you have, you know, broadly speaking, liberals versus conservatives, and perhaps liberals and conservatives versus fundamentalists, who are much more rigid in their perspective than the others, shall we say. But when you look at the religious belief structure of, say, Islam, as opposed to the religious belief structure of Christianity, then one of the major differences between the two is that within Christianity, there is quite evidently a wider range of interpretive options and therefore variations of approach and application and so on than what you find historically within Islam. So that at that level, at a purely theological level, and when you take that into Islam, then you find most good Muslims would say, well, on those criteria, I'm a fundamentalist because the range of belief options and the attitudes towards these beliefs are aligned much more with what in Christianity would be termed fundamentalism. In that respect, the term, the application of the term can be confusing. But my point is that having acknowledged that theological difficulty, the reality is that in wider common usage in the media, in politics, in wider public discourse, this term fundamentalism has now emerged out of its original Christian context to take on a broad brush meaning which can be sensibly applied into other than just simply Christian or even other than simply religious contexts. And that's really what I'm trying to tease out and understand in a bit more of a nuanced fashion so that we can more sensibly analyze and discuss what's going on with developments in certain religious tendencies in Islam, in aspects of Christianity and other religions as well that are impinging on public affairs, public discourse and so on.
One important point you make is that fundamentalism is not restricted only to religion. I remember, for example, during the headscarf debate in France, the French president Jacques Chirac being described as a secular fundamentalist. Fundamentalism is in fact possible across all ideologies, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And I think that's the key to remember here. And that is the starting point for a deeper reflection when one becomes aware that people do use this term fundamentalism in a quite sensible fashion to refer to the naming of something or an attitude or a particular dimension of an ideology or position that is not just religious at all. And therefore, the starting point is clearly when one talks about a secular fundamentalist or a political fundamentalist or whatever, is referring to someone who is of a narrow or closed mind or viewpoint in relation to a particular issue or context. So that typically, a fundamentalist does not allow for an alternative, rather wants to rule the alternatives out by saying, on whatever grounds, that is illicit, illegal, immoral, or whatever, and is not to be brooked. Whereas the opposite of that is the liberality of what we might wish to call a postmodern position in terms, to use a more contemporary parlance, which says no, diversity, variation, difference are okay. And going back to your comment about President Chirac, the irony there is here you have in secular France, the bastion of postmodern ideology, which is, you know, vive la différence, you have then, in respect to the possibility of differentiations of religious expression being allowed for, a reaction, a secular reaction, which says, no, they're not. No one is allowed to express themselves and denote themselves by way of religious garb. Everyone must wear the secular uniform of non-identification, religiously speaking. And that becomes a secular fundamentalism because what it's saying is there's only one right way and that's my way.
You may be aware of the book written by Tariq Ali, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Islam versus the West. It's an insightful critique. In regard to the so-called war against terror, Ali categorizes the current contest as occurring between two fundamentalist trajectories. On the surface, one is religious, namely the Islamic world, and the other political, namely America or the American globalized and secularized West. This latter, in Ali's view, is characterized by a shameless use of disproportional military power, and the former by carefully targeted fanaticism. Ali's fundamental thesis is that the predominating dynamic in world affairs is a clash of fundamentalisms, religious and political, and in both realistic and idealistic senses. What is being played out in Iraq, for instance, involves a combination of political and religious fundamentalisms as both real and idealized systems. The political ideal invoked in respect to the invasion was that of a Western coalition of the willing, contending with the totalitarian regime of Saddam Hussein. The ostensible aim was to liberate the world from fear of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. But there also emerged, especially as these weapons seemed highly elusive, the aim of liberating the Iraqi people from political oppression in order, among other things, to obtain religious freedoms. Such were the idealized rationales for war. On the overtly religious side, the ideal espoused what there was no attack intended on religion as such. Saddam Hussein may have happened to be Muslim, but it was not Islam per se that was the target. Yet the promotion of freedom to be religious within Iraq, that is, to be able to freely follow the religion of one's choosing, together with the making of positive overtures to a diversity of religious leadership within the country, was offered as inherently part of the overall change management dimension of the invasion plan. Thus, despite protestations to the contrary, the conflict may be cast in religious terms as yet another clash of the West's secularized Judeo-Christian religious system with that of Islam per se, and of course, winning yet again. This is an ideal perceived to be the case by some cadres, at least, of Christian fundamentalists in the West. This is especially so in the US with respect to the American new religio-political right, which had been relatively dormant since the Reagan years and which re-emerged in the context of the election and re-election of President George W. Bush. This ideal, whether perceived or manifest, of the superiority of a conservative Christian West winning over Islam has clearly been viewed as a threatening reality, one that demands to be actively resisted by many Muslims the world over. More pointedly, it reinforces a general fundamentalist viewpoint that is found in both Christian and Muslim fundamentalist variants that pictures Islam and Christianity as eternal adversaries. Much the same fundamentalist scenario holds for Islam and the Jews as any survey of contemporary Islamic and ultra-Orthodox Jewish rhetoric would testify. Which side is regarded as ultimately victorious depends on the religion espoused by the fundamentalist. The rules of engagement are the same either way. God, Allah, will guarantee the ultimate victory. The believer is simply enjoined to fight the good fight. But the war on terror is a war of ideology, in particular a war against the dominance of certain religious fundamentalisms. The key is that religious terrorism derives from an ideology of religious fundamentalism. Another commentator, writing in the aftermath of the London bombings of July 2005, seemed to get the point. Rather than taking up arms in the so-called war against terrorism, the real issue was recognized as having to do with, quote, the battle to discredit an ideology. It is an idea that caused the attack, and it is the idea that must be undermined. Authorities in England were soon reported to be examining literature for clues to the precise ideology that may have inspired the London bombers. Of course, by virtue of being extremist, individuals who carry out terrorist atrocities are probably disowned by the community of faith with which they are otherwise identified. Their actions are condemned as un-Islamic, as contrary to Quranic dictate, and inimical to normative Islam. Investigations into the London bombings revealed that as far back as January 2005, there was mounting concern within the young men's own Muslim communities that their hardening fundamentalist and extremist attitudes and opinions were taking them far beyond the pale of normative Islam. Indeed, they had been ostracized and told they were not welcome in certain mosques because of their advocacy of inappropriate teachings their increasing fundamentalism had estranged them from their own. Alongside rejection of aberrant behaviour, there's also a direct and outright denial by some, possibly many, from within the Islamic community of any Muslim link to such a situation in the first place. Attempts to redirect responsibility elsewhere, including claiming the attacks were the work of America or Israel, are not unknown. Such paradoxical and absolute denial of Islamically driven terrorism by Muslims is based on an ideological stance which goes, in effect, given that such terrorism harms Muslims and besmirches Islam, any true Muslim could not possibly commit it. This line of thought surfaced after the 9/11 attacks, when a Muslim mentality of denial led to rumours of Jewish conspiracy theories as the root cause, not Islamic disaffection, let alone an Islamic ideology as such. Straws of denial and deflection were being desperately clutched at by some. On the one hand, there is a refusal on ideological grounds to believe fellow Muslims could commit such acts of terrorism. On the other hand, Islamic extremists will target Muslim and non-Muslim alike on equally ideological grounds. So, what is driving contemporary globalized Islamic extremism and terrorism? Is it just a contemporary socio-political aberration in a religious guise? Are these little more than the anarchists of our age? Arguably, a potential measure of the propensity to terrorism can be identified in terms of a scrutiny of certain forms of Muslim rhetoric, namely, when there is an unequivocal advocacy of the view that, vis-a-vis an Islamic context, passive oppression has been eclipsed by an intentional act of oppression against Muslims and Islam. An example of the former would be the British foreign policy of non-action in Kashmir or Chechnya, and of the latter, its active involvement in the war in Iraq. That is to say, military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, or wherever, the so-called war on terror, or whatever else may be deemed to express active oppression, may be taken by Muslims as indeed acts against Islam itself. So acts against Muslims in a specific context are translated into acts conducted against Islam generally and universally, thereby calling forth and legitimating, by virtue of the logic and rhetoric of jihad, an aggressive Islamic response. Where such rhetoric of advocacy and argumentation is fomented, there may well be a case for preemptive countering action on the part of authorities concerned. The problem, of course, is that such action only reinforces the rhetoric. It would seem moderate Muslim communities appear unable to foresee the possibility of terrorist activities emanating from their midst. But then again, why should they? This suggests that there is a very real difficulty for religious people to understand the range of ideological options and the significance of the shifts that occur in an individual's ideological stance from within their own religion. This would seem acutely the case for many Muslim communities right now, but should in no way be deemed a uniquely Muslim issue. But where does all this leave the wider society? How are we to address the challenge of fundamentalism and terrorism? The primary component in any strategy aimed at countering religiously motivated terrorism, I suggest, has to be in respect to identifying and addressing ideological rhetoric and elements within communities from which potential terrorists are likely to come, and by which they are likely to be nourished. But to do that, to make sense of any potential data or evidence, we need a framework of interpretation, a lens of perspective. It is in respect to this that we now turn to an analysis of religious fundamentalism as offering a paradigm for terrorism.
The University of Waikato's Douglas Pratt features in this encounter on ABC Radio National. The subject is terrorism and fundamentalism. You rightly point out that fundamentalism in itself doesn't lead necessarily to terrorism, but that there's something about fundamentalism that allows terrorism to develop. How do you set about trying to understand this link?
Well, that's the task I've been pursuing over this last year or so, and I'm happy to say that I think I've reached a point now where it feels like I have got hold of an analysis which is workable and useful and not in itself so closed as to become a fundamentalist analysis of fundamentalism. I mean, one has to maintain a sense of openness and provisionality, which of course is the mark of non-fundamentalism. But anyhow, my analysis would suggest that we could think of fundamentalism as embracing three dimensions or three phases. There's a passive form of, or phase of fundamentalism, a more assertive phase or form, and clearly an activist phase or form. And you can then start to break that down and tease that out a bit more. Broadly speaking, one could identify with passive fundamentalism an awful lot of religious viewpoints, even groups, that one commonly thinks of as fundamentalist in that camp. A lot of contemporary Christian spirituality, Christian religiosity that is labeled fundamentalist is in that camp. It's passive. It's simply a religious worldview that is held in a particular kind of way, but it doesn't spill out into anything else in particular. Then you have an assertive dimension where you do begin to see it spilling out. For example, more overtly, there are certain Christian groups and other groups, not just Christian only, that assert their fundamentalism, and particularly and primarily with respect to their own members. Their own members, for example, are duty-bound to tithe, to give one-tenth of their income. There's no option in that. That's what you must do. Things like that. So you have an assertiveness coming through. The classic case, which has been in the headlines on both sides of the Tasman in recent times, has, of course, been with the Exclusive Brethren group. By their very name, Exclusive, indicates that there's something quite assertive and hard line about that form of fundamentalism. And as one comes to understand it, one can see the point. Certainly with respect to their members, there's very strong constraints placed upon members, very strong values of maintaining the identity of the group over against the rest of the world and so on and so forth. So a lot of sects and cults and other very narrow groups, highly assertive, can come within that hard-line dimension of fundamentalism. And then you get to the what I'm just loosely calling activist fundamentalism, where that sense of assertiveness then gets notched up to a point where the fundamentalist mindset, values, and presuppositions are deemed not just to be applicable to those who, as it were, buy in, who are part of the group, but are deemed to have some applicability to the wider society around them. Now, you know, interestingly, the case of the Exclusive Brethren, again, has indicated in some regards there's been a shift in their stance. They have moved from an assertive phase into a more activist phase. They are now actively, through their own means, wanting to influence what's going on in the world around them. So they're not just withdrawing passively and asserting themselves in terms of their members, but are actively engaging in political actions and so on, which brings them into the public arena and means that they are impacting on wider society. Now, certain other religious groups do likewise, and when you take this analysis into the arena of, say, Islamist groups, then you see something similar, moving from an assertiveness in respect of their own membership, as it were, their own people, into an activism that wants to impose itself on everybody else regardless. And you see that most dramatically in some forms of the terrorist movements such as Al-Qaeda and so on today.
As a framework phenomenon that applies to more than just religion, fundamentalism is comprised, I suggest, of at least 14 key factors. Others may be adduced, but these 14 and the way they are interconnected need to be carefully understood. For it is these features collectively and cumulatively which, I suggest, move a fundamentalist mindset from the quirky to the critical, from atavism to aggression, from benign eccentricity to socially endangering activity. The factors I have identified are analysed in terms of seven sets of paired features. I should add, when I began this a year ago, it was three sets of paired features. So the paradigm is evolving. This is a work in progress. Nonetheless, the point is that I've analysed it in this particular way, and my contention is that it is the particular sequential combination of these factors which is important, not just the elements themselves. So, the first set is what I call principal presuppositions. And there are two, perspectival absolutism and immediate inerrancy. The fundamentalist perspective is inherently absolutist. All other relevant phenomena are simply explained on its terms or viewed as in a relativizing way with reference to it. Fundamentalism as a mindset is first and foremost a mentality that expresses the modernist project writ large. Only one truth, one authority, one authentic narrative that accounts for all, one right way to be. Further, the fundamentalist perspective deems itself privileged in respect to this absolutism, for it implies superiority of knowledge and truth. Indeed, this is inherent to holding an absolutist perspective as such. Absolutism of outlook or worldview is a mark of fundamentalism, but not of itself a signal of potential terrorist activity in respect to that worldview. That comes much later. Allied to absolutism is the view that the grounding text, be it political manifesto or holy writ, is to be read as conveying an immediate truth or value without error, that is, inerrant. However, the assertion of immediate inerrancy of the text, that is, reading the text as being immediately applicable and providing a non-mediated access to ultimate or divine truth, in fact involves an implicit assertion that there is only one normative interpretive reading allowed, namely, that which is undertaken through the fundamentalist lens. A fundamentalist presumption of textual immediacy and inerrancy is, of course, but one interpretive option. Nevertheless, from the fundamentalist perspective, alternative and variant interpretations are deemed inherently false or heretical and so are rejected. These two interconnected factors, perspectival absolutism and immediate inerrancy, comprise the foundational or principal presuppositions of religious fundamentalism, which, on their own right, might simply indicate one among many options for the expression of religious belief. Most often, a secularist, an agnostic, or a religious liberal in the West would likely view these factors to be the essence of fundamentalism as such, an atavistic expression of religion, a quirky mindset, a rather odd, out-of-step religious mentality, proof positive that religion amounts to little more than fairy tales, easily ignored, best avoided, of no consequence or significance to the greater scheme of things. But, I contend, this is not all there is to fundamentalism. So we come to the second set of factors, which I call authority derivation. And again, there are two. The assumption of apodicity and what I call a narrow narrative indwelling. Building directly upon the preceding set, the third and fourth factors of this analysis constitutes the basis of authority claimed by fundamentalism as such, namely, in the first instance, the assumption that the authority source, most usually textual, is unambiguous, thus requiring no interposing hermeneutic. This is sometimes understood in terms of literalism, but for a fundamentalist, the key issue is that the authority of the text is such that no intermediary interpretive framework is required. The text itself provides pellucid expression of truth, whether in terms of an abstract universal or in respect to a pragmatic or programmatic articulation of the values and views espoused by the fundamentalist as the truth. This provides the authorization underlying the preceding presupposition of immediate inerrancy. Paradoxically, of course, any so-called literalist reading or regarding a text as not requiring any intentional hermeneutical application is itself a modality of interpretation, namely a fundamentalist one. It is often assumed by a fundamentalist that a direct reading of the text can be made so as to avoid the murky waters of interpretation. That is, there is no need to apply any sort of intellectual critique or scrutiny of the text. Meaning can be immediately read off. The text at hand is clear in its composition. The message conveyed by the text is apodictic. Nevertheless, allied to the assumption of apodicity is the factor of narrow narrative indwelling. Arguably, all religious people indwell, to a greater or lesser degree, their respective religious narrative. The life references, points of meaning and frameworks of understanding which inform a religious individual's existence are more often than not traceable to the paradigms, models, values and so on that are given within the religious narrative, the scriptural record as well as ancillary histories, stories and so forth, then derived simply from intellectual ratiocination of doctrine and dogma. Where the narrative base is broad, The religious life that indwells therein likewise reflects breadth. But where the base is narrow, the resultant indwelt religious life is correspondingly confined. So my thesis is that, in the case of fundamentalism, a distinguishing factor has to do with the narrowness of narrative indwelling. It is indeed this very narrowness which often marks a fundamentalist out from the wider religious tradition and community, which, in contrast, will have a tendency to admit a wider reading of its narrative and a capacity to indwell it in respect to symbolic meanings and aesthetic allusions, for instance, with a measure of interpretive flexibility. But we come to the third set, what I call contextual scope, and this includes a paradoxical conjunction of exclusivism and inclusivism, but it's ideological exclusivism coupled with polity inclusivism. This is an apparent paradoxical juxtaposition. But the first is ideological exclusivism, wherein, because there is only one reading, only one interpretation of the grounding text allowed, the ideological view expressed therein or built thereon is inevitably an exclusive one. No competing or variant ideological view is granted credibility. A fundamentalist perspective will exclude virtually automatically anything that relative to it appears liberal, that is, that admits, for example, of any limitation, provisionality, otherness, openness, or change. Religious fundamentalism excludes religious liberalism. Similarly, secular fundamentalism often excludes religion as such on the same sorts of grounds. Ideological exclusivism works in multiple directions. But alongside this exclusivity, there may be discerned as a sixth factor to fundamentalism a form of inclusion, namely polity inclusion. This is the propensity to include, in respect to consideration of the policies and praxis of social organization, all others that fall within the fundamentalist frame of reference or worldview understanding. This may still appear innocuous, especially if the fundamentalists' concern are a minor or marginalised group in terms of the wider society in which they exist, or where such an inclusive stance finds a more benign setting within a normative or orthodox religious tradition. Nevertheless, in terms of this paradigm analysis, the fundamentalist, for whom polity inclusiveness is a primary element, is now poised to become activist, to act on this inclusivism in terms of polity, whether covertly, as in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints vicariously baptizing the dead, or overtly, as in the Taliban's insistence that everyone in Afghanistan live according to their application of Islam, and variations on this theme found currently in parts of Pakistan and Nigeria. So the apparent paradox of fundamentalism, evincing both exclusivism and inclusivism as two of its core features, is resolved. Excluding all other ideological variants and perspectives necessarily implies the wholesale inclusion of a society in terms of the outworking of polity considerations. Thus, for example, the fundamentalism of a resurgent Islamist perspective naturally insists not just that all Muslims should live according to Islamic law, but that all members of the society in question, irrespective of religion, should likewise submit to this law code, understood, of course, to transcend human values and codes by virtue of being God's law.
And you're with Encounter on ABC Radio National, where we're exploring the links between fundamentalism and terrorism with Dr. Douglas Pratt from the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. Douglas Pratt identifies 14 key factors that make up the fundamentalist mindset. These he's condensed into 7 sets of paired features, the fourth of which examines identity structure, comprising what he calls communitarian intent and individual constraint.
The fundamentalist mindset is not simply a matter of opinion and perspective as held by an individual or a collective of individuals. The factor of communitarian intent denotes the way in which fundamentalist movements place value, to a greater or lesser degree, upon membership of the community and the upholding of its values and norms as essential to the community, such that the identity of individuals within the community is thereby proscribed. Thus, the factor of individual constraint is the necessary corollary, and the two factors go together to form the structure of fundamentalist identity, irrespective of the specific religion. Many examples can be adduced to make the point. That of the Exclusive Brethren, which, as I mentioned, has been in the headlines recently, may suffice. With respect to the Islamic idea and ideal of the Ummah, that notion of community which roughly parallels the Christian concept of ecclesia, membership of it is essential, not voluntary. For the Muslim individual, such that a withdrawal from the community on account, for example, of a change in individual religious identity, is viewed as apostasy, a treasonable offence attracting severe sanction in some quarters. To this extent, Islam presents as a fundamentalist religion per se, which in many respects it is. But that does not mean that Islam is necessarily inherently violent. Nevertheless, this set of factors, to the extent they are legitimately part of a paradigm, arguably may contribute in the end to a predisposition and justification of violent behaviour. Of course, this has been the case historically for Christianity, at least in the form of Western Christendom. And there are Christian denominations and sects for whom the essential dynamic of fundamentalist identity structures would certainly apply. Now move on to the fifth set, implicit verification, and the two factors are narrative correlation and rhetorical corroboration. Principal presuppositions granted, the derivation of authority established, the contextual scope adumbrated and identity demarcated, the evolving fundamentalist perspective begins now to move from a variant conservative expression of a religious worldview to a more intentional advocacy of religious viewpoint as being par excellence, the expression of authenticity and truth applicable for or to all. This comes about initially with the deepening of the correlation between the religious narrative espoused and the reality of the religious community concerned. Any phenomenology of religion will be able to articulate some such measure of narrative correlation as an otherwise quite normal feature of religion as such. That is to say, normatively, a religion will proffer some degree of correlation between its narrative and the real world in which the followers of the religion live. Otherwise, religion would reduce to a simple and obvious fairy tale. However, a distinction can be made between the broader traditions of religion whose narrative correlation will be relatively loose, flexible, or at least provisional, and the fundamentalist whose degree of correlation will be that much greater and intense. Indeed, this factor sharpens and is prefaced by the factors of absolutism and inerrancy. For a fundamentalist, the correlation will be such as to yield an unambiguous outcome. For example, America is the great Satan, ontologically, whereas for a non-fundamentalist critical of the West, America may be judged satanic in a more general way. The difference is one of the degree of correlation between the religious narrative and the external realities of the world in which the fundamentalist lives. Allied to narrative correlation is the factor of rhetorical corroboration. Here, the discourse of fundamentalism can be more readily tested, perhaps. For in the articulation of narrative correlation, there is likely to be found a corresponding intensification of a corroborating rhetoric that situates, endorses, and justifies the fundamentalist perspective vis-a-vis the judgments and assessments made about the external world in terms of narrative correlation. Rhetoric will be sharp and self-affirming. Judgments will be clear and reflective of both the correlation factor as well as the corroboration factor. Thus, the perspective of the fundamentalist derives implicit verification, and the scene is set for the next step, namely the application of the values espoused from out of the fundamentalist narrative. So value application, and there are two. Otherness is negated and self-superiority asserted. At this stage in the development of a fundamentalist outlook, the sense of self-affirmation and confidence is such that the values of fundamentalism are actively and intentionally applied. And these values are primarily two: the negation of otherness or alterity, and the corresponding assertion of self-superiority over all opponents, real and putative. The negation of otherness is perhaps critical at this juncture for the scene set by the third set of factors, the contextualizing exclusivism and inclusivism, now emerge into a devaluing and dismissal of the other, whether in terms of rival community or competing alterities, ideological or otherwise. Indeed, such alterities may be, and in fact often are, demonized. The religiously other on this view is often cast as satanic, or at least seriously and significantly labeled as a hostile opponent, and so hostilely regarded. In the process of negating the other, the self is asserted as inherently superior. My God is greater than your God. My truth reigns over your ignorance. The authenticity of my faith contrasts with the feeble delusion you entertain. My laws express the divine reality directly, which is infinitely superior to the laws which derive merely from human ideas, and so on. However it is expressed or referenced, it will be clear enough that the fundamentalist is applying the key value set of negativity to otherness and a corresponding assertion of self-superiority. The scene is now well set for the seventh and final set of factors I've analysed as the components of a paradigm of fundamentalism, rendering an explicit justification not just for the viewpoint but also for actions premised on that viewpoint. So the seventh set, explicit justification involving sanctioned impositioned and legitimated extremism. It should be clear that once the preceding sets of factors are in operation, it is but a short step to the final two, which denote the expression of fundamentalism in some form of direct socio-political action. For the 13th factor sees the very imposition of the fundamentalist views and polity as in fact sanctioned by a higher or greater authority. Whether that authority is conceived in terms of deity or the dynamics of historical necessity. This reference transcends the local, particular, ordinary, taken-for-granted freedoms of everyday life, with the requirement to be, live, and do in accord with the fundamentalist ideological dictates. The sanctioning of the imposition of the fundamentalist program leads naturally to the 14th and final factor of this analysis. Extremist action is now legitimated. Once there is in place a sense of transcendent sanction for programmatic action, the way to the legitimizing extreme behaviors to achieve the requisite outcomes is eased. Japanese kamikaze pilots and Palestinian suicide bombers are two examples, now classical in terms of recent history, of the outworking of the features of fundamentalism that culminate in extreme actions. More complexly, as we have recently seen in Afghanistan, not only was it the case that all good Muslims ought to submit naturally to the Sharia, according to the fundamentalist ideals of the Taliban, but indeed all of society should be made to submit, like it or not. For impositional submission is an inherent element of Islamic extremism. Submission to the dictates of the fundamentalist is at this juncture a matter of necessary imposition, as Afghani women found to their cost, for example. And the alternative to even an involuntary submission is outright destruction. Hence, from the Taliban's extreme perspective, the Buddha idols had to be destroyed. How else does the extremist ensure that the imposition that has been sanctioned can actually be effected? Sanctioned imposition and legitimated extremism are the two sides of the one coin in the currency of terror.
I'm trying to set up a series of indicators that will give a clue as to a sequential development should one be in the offing. And the interesting test case for me is seeing that there has been a sequential shift, at least in terms of the brethren. So that kind of is indicative of the paradigm in action. Often with looking at the particular terrorist groups, such as the London bombings last year and others, we're now material has come to hand about who was involved and what they were doing beforehand and so on and so forth. One can presumably look at the evidence of the antecedent behaviours and contacts and so on to see if that actually gives a clue as to the kind of things one should be looking for. And certainly that's what I know counter-terrorist authorities have been investigating. Well, I'm looking at the similar kind of stuff and allied stuff, and it's premised on the notion that okay, you can get certain expressions which fit in with, shall we say, the assertive phase, where those expressions then tip over into inculcations or invitations to act or giving credence to people's action or just giving almost permission to act, then there's a sense in which there's a shift going on. And my hypothesis would be that it is legitimate in terms of the scrutinising of public utterances, such as made by sheikhs, as we have seen, or preachers, or whoever, scrutinising literature that's in the public domain, and of course one particular virulent form of that is now in terms of the internet, which is a hard one to keep tabs on. But the point is that it's discerning the difference between someone offering an opinion and someone endorsing or promoting an action. And if that can be correlated to a paradigm of fundamentalism in the context that I'm trying to understand it, then maybe my suggestion is that there is then a grounds for being able to take appropriate action or make certain responses, whatever. The alternative is simply that you don't do this kind of analytical work and you flounder around and end up running the risk of labelling anybody who is intensely religious as a fundamentalist and therefore as a prospective terrorist. And so, you know, an awful lot of people will be taking umbrage at that possibility. But that kind of broad brush or heavy-handed approach at the moment is certainly risked in certain areas.
Fundamentalism is not simply a religious or even political option in terms of belief perspective. It is a package deal phenomenon denoted by a sequence of factors whose cumulative impact once or if the seventh set is reached can be devastating. The Taliban, to turn again to this example of Islamic fundamentalist extremism, took an absolutist, inerrant and exclusivist line with respect to their religious identity and behaviour, which was extended to include all who were within their purview, namely the inhabitants of Afghanistan. Actions taken to effect their aims were deemed sanctioned by the highest authority, Allah or God, and their extreme measures were in consequence deemed legitimated. Thus no opposition was brooked. All had to submit and obey or face the consequences. To the extent my analysis of the paradigm of religious fundamentalism as such is in any way apposite and accurate, and to the extent that empirical evidence, derived, for example, from speeches, pamphlets, etc., can be adduced such that there is a clear correlation with the paradigmatic elements as I've outlined them, then I suggest that this provides a basis at least for an empirical measure for the detection of extremist religious fundamentalism, Islamic as well as any other, likely to lead to terrorist activity. Of course, religious fundamentalism of itself does not necessarily lead to terrorism. There are examples of plenty of religious fundamentalists who are pacifist in outlook and demeanour, including the vast majority of Muslims. But fundamentalism may lead to terrorism, and in some cases it does. Hopefully this paradigm analysis will help explain why and assist in the process of addressing it. Thank you.
Dr. Douglas Pratt, Director of the Religious Studies Program, the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. He was giving the keynote address at a conference on truth and truthfulness in uncertain times, organised recently by the Catholic Institute of Sydney. And you've been listening to Encounter on ABC Radio National. Technical production this week by Andrei Shubanov and Louis Mitchell. I'm Gary Bryson. Thanks for your company.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.